Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Here on the Aerospace Advantage, we speak with leaders in the DoD industry and other subject matter experts to explore the intersection of strategy, operational concepts, technology, and policy when it comes to air and space power. So if you like learning about aerospace power, you are in the right place. Now, to our regular listeners, again, thank you and welcome back. And if it's your first time here, thank you so much for joining us. And as a reminder, if you like what you're hearing today, do us a favor and follow our show. Please give us a like and leave a comment so that we can keep charting the trajectories that matter to you most. Now, this week, it's time for The Rendezvous, our monthly installment where the Mitchell team digs into stories that you've seen in the headlines. All right, guys, welcome. We've got Mark Gunzinger.
Hello, Slick. How are you doing today?
Heather Penny.
Hey, Slick. Good to be back.
Doug Berkey.
Hey, man. How's it going?
Lucas Ottenried.
Hey, great to be here with everybody.
And Daniel Rice.
Thanks for having me, Slick.
Now, just before we kick things off, I wanted to lay some context regarding today's discussion, which is going to focus on Ukraine. Now, we've held off on this one for a while because we didn't want to be one more uninformed voice piling on. Now, there are some trend lines that warrant the discussion, and it's still important to flag that we're speaking with limited knowledge, so our observations will evolve as we learn more. And it's also crucial to highlight that we discuss strategy, operational concepts, and technology. We need to focus on the fact that there are innocent lives on the line, and none of us can forget the images that we're seeing of incredible suffering and loss. And from our perspective, this war did not have to happen. Putin chose to invade, but he didn't have to. And that gives the United States, the European Union, and NATO a lot to think about regarding future deterrent strategies, because frankly, what we've had in place leading up to this clearly failed. So, Gonzo, let's get started with you. Why do you think Putin ultimately decided to act, and why weren't we able to deter this conflict?
Great question, Slick. Let me start by saying, now, this invasion was not without precedent for the Putin regime, except for its scale. So it's no surprise to me and most others. Russia invaded Georgia in 2008, and then Donbass and eastern Ukraine in 2014, and of course it seized and annexed Crimea. So Russia suffered somewhat from international sanctions after those military adventures, but the costs were bearable, and its oil and gas exports to Western Europe and other states continued. And we also can't discount the failure of many of our NATO allies to maintain the size of their militaries and modernize for modern warfare. And that has overall greatly eroded NATO's ability to deter Russia. And Putin is well aware of that and the fact that we have cut our own forces by about half since the end of the Cold War. We've traded off modernization programs to fund discretionary small wars in the Middle East, and we've gutted our military posture in Europe relative to the Cold War. And while the much-heralded 2018 National Defense Strategy finally shifted DoD's focus toward deterring and defeating peer aggression, it also required our services to size their forces for one war with China or Russia, not both, as well as defend U.S. homeland, sustain our nuclear posture, and deter a lesser second aggressor. So it's now well known that DoD believes that China is its pacing threat, and Russia is a lesser challenge, perhaps even a lesser included challenge. So that's quite possible that Putin read all this and saw the U.S. pivot to the Indo-Pacific as evidence that we are now less committed to the defense of Europe. In fact, I've been asked that question many times by some of our European allies. And finally, I believe Putin's hasty abandonment of Afghanistan, Germany's reluctance to decrease its reliance on Russian oil and gas, and other factors as signs of NATO's weakness and inability to form a consensus. All that could have added up, at least in Putin's mind, to a green light for an invasion of Ukraine.
Okay, so what does everybody else think?
I think one of the biggest challenges here is really what Gonzo highlighted. It's all about resolve. And people have, in the news especially, have talked about this as a new action. And we've talked about this before as a team. This is a continuation. It's been ongoing for years. And really, there's not been a penalty paid for it. And so if you look at it from Putin's perspective, why not do it? And I think if you look at the military force that he put there, it certainly was not the grade A team. I think it really spoke to the notion that he thought he was going to roll in fast and clean up and nobody was going to do anything, including the Ukrainians, because that's what's happened every single time before.
Yeah, let's also not forget that almost immediately before his invasion, he had a meeting with Xi Jinping, and he almost got tacit support for the invasion, right? So he also had that backdoor or that kind of out in case things went wrong. He could look to China to try to alleviate some of the pressures of, let's say, the sanctions that we've imposed. So that's an important consideration as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Exactly. And with the environment, we've essentially accepted and tolerated Putin's behaviors. So, you know, although our national defense strategy shifted in 2018 to begin to focus on peer conflict, it's been a lot of talk and very little resourcing, right? 4 years later, have we really seen significant changes in terms of our programmatics and our capabilities to back that up?
That's a shock, Heather. It really is.
Okay, Heather, it's no secret that the Russian military performance has been far from impressive. They'll likely occupy the country, but it's going to be a brutal war of attrition and occupation, and that's just not smart strategy. So why do you think this happened?
Well, let's say first, that was not their strategy, right? As Doug mentioned, the Russians believed, Putin believed that he was going to be able to waltz in with minimal resistance and be able to occupy the country and have regime change within 3 days, right? That's pretty clear from what we saw from their planning. And they foresized appropriately. And so this shift towards attrition and occupation is a change in their strategy. They're adapting to the environment. So I think the first thing we need to say is that that was not their initial strategy, but they have experience doing this, and we are beginning to see them basically revisit how they have done operations in Syria, right? So we're seeing the bombings of hospitals, we're seeing massive targeting of civilians, but we're also seeing them actually bring forward more capable military capabilities. I think one thing that's really important here, though, is that we should not draw conclusions about the Russian military capability based off of the first 2 weeks of this conflict. A lot of people are now saying, oh, well, hey, you know, Russia, this big bad bear, couldn't even invade Ukraine within 2 days. They must really be just nothing but, you know, a shadow force. It's a Potemkin village. I don't think that's true. And I think that that's a very dangerous conclusion to come to.
Heather, I just want to jump in on one other piece here. If you look at a lot of the conversation that's happened at a policy and political level in this country, I think there's tremendous mirror imaging of our own values. And we have been thinking that other countries subscribe to those. And if you look at some of the recent hearings, for example, on the use of unmanned aerial vehicles and all of that, we are flogging ourselves to a level that I'd say is almost absurd. And beating ourselves up in ways that are really empowering aggressors who don't hold our values to act, because we're handcuffing ourselves so much, and it is read as tremendous weakness. If we don't like getting, you know, seeing hospitals getting bombed and mass targeting of civilians, which is a tactic that the Russians have used over and over again, like you said, Syria or Chechnya or all these other places, the only way to deal with that, because that is their playbook, is really deterring them up front, and that is peace through strength, and that is actually having resolve for decisive action, not this hand-wringing of how many angels, you know, can we count on a pinhead here of trying to get the nth degree of accuracy when, you know, look, we try. That is our value proposition, and that's where we come from as people. But when it actually is read as weakness, it is going to really degrade how people read us and our decisive attitude here.
Okay, Gonzo, what about the lessons people are going to take away from this regarding the kind of capabilities that we're going to need in the future? I'm hearing folks say that we don't need cutting-edge systems because the Russians can't even shoot down a primitive Ukrainian UAV. What are your thoughts here?
Well, Slick, the short answer is that would be the exact wrong lesson learned. Now, as you've mentioned, Heather and Doug, Russia is not performing as many expected, but we should not assume that Russia will fight a war against NATO the same way it's now fighting in Ukraine.
Exactly.
That would be a foolish assumption. So, and what our allies need. Let me talk about insights from war games I've participated in or led with many of our NATO allies, including exercises that focused on the defense of Poland and the Baltics. First, our forces have to be there, which means postured in Europe or capable of quickly responding to the battle space from out of theater. Now, I'll never forget one Polish Army colonel who told me the biggest difference between our militaries is, and I quote, "We are here and you are not." Next in priority is aerospace power, because only air forces can respond from inside and outside of Europe within hours to go on the offensive to begin to blunt a Russian invasion of NATO. It can take days to deploy ground forces from even Western Europe into the Baltics or elsewhere along NATO's Eastern Front, and it would take weeks for heavy ground forces to arrive from Canada, the U.S., and even the U.K. So our allies need U.S. air forces that can fight with our NATO air force partners and can sustain those high-capacity strikes on Russian missile launchers, their long-range artillery, and other fire systems. We need 5th and 6th gen fighters to gain air superiority to provide cover for our friendly forces in contact with the Russian invasion force to counter Russia's IADs, and of course, unmanned aircraft of all classes, including some that are trainable, to find, fix, and track targets in contested areas. NATO's electromagnetic warfare capabilities and air and missile offenses are also sorely lacking. So just to wrap up, our allies in Europe can and should procure many of those capabilities, but none of them can bring to the fight the long-range strike capacity of our bomber forces, and let's not forget our space assets to provide connectivity and a persistent view of the battle space. Only we can do that.
All right, Doug, there's been a lot of talk of no-fly zones. Is this a good idea or bad idea?
Well, obviously having the effect of a no-fly zone would be great if Russia wasn't able to use air power to gain some pretty key advantages at times with targeting key elements throughout Ukraine and other aspects that they're using. That'd be great. But here's the problem. You can't have a no-fly zone unless you are willing to pull the trigger. Putin isn't going to just ground his air force because we decide to create a no-fly zone. It involves us being willing to pull a trigger and shoot down one of his aircraft. And that means, are we willing to go into a kinetic action against a nuclear peer adversary? And that could spiral out in incredibly dangerous ways. And I would argue right now, and this is absolutely crucial when we see the budget coming up for release, we really don't have the numbers to back up what it would take to execute a no-fly zone. So, look, obviously we've got some older aircraft, F-15s, F-16s, types like that, but do you really want to risk those against some very sophisticated air defense systems, you know, double-digit SAMs and all that? So you're really going down to your fifth-gen fleet. So right now, just talking Air Force only right now, but they do have the biggest, you know, chunks out of all of this. There are about 330 F-35s in the Air Force inventory currently. About 160 of those are in training and test units. You cannot really access those for combat roles. And then 150 are actually operational. Now, you don't just surge 150 jets at a given time to maintain air superiority for a no-fly zone. What you have to do is rotate them. And so, you know, you kind of divide by three. And so one third is going to be on station executing the mission. A third is probably coming home, and a third is getting ready to launch. So, you know, you do that math, and you're down to, you know, about 50. And let's explain how big Ukraine is. I mean, if you began at Chicago, it would run all the way to the Atlantic, and it goes from about Detroit through Kentucky. That is a massive, massive amount of territory. 50 F-35s would be diluted very, very quickly. Now, okay, we've got F-22s as well. Okay, so there are 186 of those. About 100 are operational. And so you do the math on that, you're in 30-ish territory. And then you add in the pilot shortfall that we have right now. So you really cannot afford much attrition here because we can't even sustain peacetime demand for pilots. There are issues about armament with air-to-air missiles and risks we've taken there with our stocks. And by the way, I haven't even talked about maintaining operations in the Pacific. So this is giving a complete set of permissions for China to go do what it wants, because we don't have any fifth-gen air power in the Pacific in this scenario, or the Mideast, or North Korea, or wherever you want to talk about. So I think it's a really, really challenging set of circumstances that we face here. And we could empower the Ukrainians to do more. And obviously there's the topic of the Polish MiG-29s and all that. I don't think we know all the aspects that have played on that or will play. But I will say this. If, in fact, we are deterred from facilitating the transfer of those aircraft, then we have really lost in a huge way. And that is dangerous, because it further empowers Putin to saber rattle and get us to back down. There is precedent for transfers. Obviously, we did that before we entered World War II with Lend-Lease. We also did it during the Yom Kippur War by direct transfer of F-4 Phantoms to Israel, with U.S. crews flying them in-country while that war was hot, because things are so bad. So I think it's something we just need to be very careful about. Clearly, the Ukrainians need as much as they can get, and they need things that are plug-and-play. You are not going to train them up on Western systems and create infrastructure for anything that isn't as simple as a man pad. And so a MiG-29 option isn't necessarily a bad idea, but if we're self-deterred, that's a huge problem.
Let me ring in. I absolutely agree with Doug. The level of effort needed to enforce a no-fly zone over a country, the area of Ukraine, would be a step up the escalatory ladder. It just doesn't make sense. And I hope, Slick, that our listeners are shocked by some of the numbers that Doug mentioned, because that's the force that we would have to use to fight tonight in the Indo-Pacific or in the Baltics or whatever. And that should hopefully shock many people. And the final point, of course, is let's give Ukraine all the tools that we possibly can to fight for freedom of the skies. And that includes transfer of the MiG-29s. It makes no sense whatsoever to stop that from happening.
Doug and Gonzo, I love, Doug, how you operationalized this whole discussion about the no-fly zone. And Gonzo, what you said about what are the lessons learned and how do we apply this to the Indo-Pacific? I mean, Doug, what we're really talking about here is air superiority, the ability to control the skies.
Bingo.
And that is something I think that is, people initially began to say, it's still contested. I think this needs to reinforce in our minds how crucial it is that we resource the Air Force so that we can provide air superiority, because we are seeing the impact of not having that kind of air superiority and control of the skies on what happens to the ground war, right? So it's not just about making sure that they don't have fighters airborne. It's also about suppressing their air defenses as well as their surface-to-surface missiles. So that's another key aspect of air superiority and control of the skies that's really important. And so we need to make sure that we're getting the right lessons learned, because we're not resourcing the service right now to be able to provide air superiority for the joint force no matter where we go. And when I say the service, I'm talking about the U.S. Air Force, not just the Ukrainian Air Force, right? So there's a lot of lessons learned we can take from this conflict and do some navel gazing for ourselves and say, are we really ready to fight something similar? And when Doug mentioned the size of Ukraine, man, that's nothing compared to the Pacific. So when you extend those ranges, you're really compressing the time on station. Basically, by the time the jet shows up, it's got to leave because it's out of gas. It doesn't have enough fuel to be able to stay on station and actually be able to execute its mission. So that then says, hey, if we have more ranges, we need to actually have more numbers, Gonzo, like what you said, as well as air refueling. And so that's another key capability that we need to be looking at across those ranges. So thank you for bringing up not just how do we actually implement this and the diplomatic impact of having the resolve to be able to do this, but what are the lessons learned we need to take when we transition to the Pacific? And we need to be able to do that in both theaters.
Yeah, Heather, one last point, if I could jump in.
Absolutely.
I remember the very first war game I led in Poland with the Polish military and U.S. military combined. And it was obvious that our Polish allies thought that, the U.S. Air Force is going to roll in. they're going to control the skies, and that's going to enable us to do all these things in support of Poland's and NATO ground forces. And I'll never forget an F-22 pilot standing up and says, no, wait a minute. You're assuming that our F-15s, F-16s, even the A-10s are going to be survivable, and they're not. And we don't have the fifth-gen air forces yet to do that. Well, we're building toward that, but we don't have it yet. And that was a big shock for our allies in the game.
Well, and Gonzo, to that point, I mean, think about it. The F-15s, the F-16s, the A-10s, they weren't survivable in the 80s. That's why we had such massive inventories to account for the attrition and loss. So it's been numerous decades since then. And Heather, I'm glad you mentioned refueling, because that's another piece. It's also command and control and refueling that will support a no-fly zone. And that's why you're actually seeing the Air Force going to roll forward with a request for the E-7 Wedgetail this time around, because the AWACS we currently have were really designed and built predominantly in the 70s, and they are so fragile. They're one of the weakest links in the force right now. Those have to be recapped, because if you don't understand how to employ air power and what's going on in theater, you're just, you know, bumbling around in there, and that doesn't work. And on the tanker front, it's a very complicating factor, because you cannot roll those forward, or you likely won't roll those forward amidst the defenses. And that's to your point about why these would be pretty short time on station, because we got to keep these guys more at the periphery where they're not going to get shot down a lot. But that's a fragile force as well, and that's why we've got to modernize it.
Yeah, Heather, I just wanted to mention, too, I think you made a really great point that, you know, maintaining a no-fly zone and maintaining that air superiority isn't just about clearing the skies of Russian jets. It's also about those ground-based air defenses. And a lot of those are in place within Russia. So it's not just about, you know, giving the Ukrainians freedom of action, but when you say no-fly zone, are we actually prepared to go fly into Russia and attack those targets? And that's a major escalation.
Hey, so like, I just want to toss a question your way. You've flown a lot of combat missions. What are your thoughts on what you're seeing here? And maybe more importantly, what aren't you seeing?
Well, I think the big thing, Doug, that I've said kind of tongue-in-cheek to my friends, I feel like, you know, my ROTC seniors could have planned a better strategy regarding what to do on night one and in the following initial days to initially secure air superiority and make sure that my own ground forces would be protected going in once we had that established. The thing that I'm seeing is a lot of disjointed air power from the Russian side. It's amazing, being under attack, the amount of pushback from an air power perspective the Ukrainians have done, and it's been absolutely impressive. But what I'm also seeing is, you know, the capabilities that the Russians are not putting up a large force with regard to their air power. You know, we're not seeing, you know, 6, 8, 10 ships of coordinated attacks. We're seeing 1 and 2 ship formations flying at low level under the weather. So that tells me that there's not a lot of capability when it comes to precision guidance through the weather. And, you know, frankly, we're just seeing very rudimentary tactics, although they're using, you know, big jets to do it. So I think that's the biggest thing that's been a shocking thing to see roll out in the news. So Dan, over to you. How is China interpreting this? Standing shoulder to shoulder with Putin at the opening on the Olympics certainly sent a strong message.
You know, Slick, it did send a strong message, and it's really one of the biggest actions we've seen Beijing take in terms of drawing clear geopolitical lines in a long time. Remember, this is a country that has no formal alliances, so the joint statement that came out of Putin and Xi's meeting holds a lot of weight. As far as the idea that the China-Russia partnership knows no limits, as they put it, I think that Ukraine is showing us that while there may be no limits, fundamentally, both China and Russia are still going to act in a way that achieves their own personal interests. So I think both Putin and Xi probably believed that a Russian invasion of Ukraine would be really fast and that Ukraine would just kind of fall over. But clearly Putin and Xi were wrong here. Now, as the war stretches into its third week, China's doing a bit of damage control, as things like Chinese civilian casualties in Ukraine and the secondary effects of sanctions hit home. So how that has played out is that we see China perpetuating the misinformation that Putin has concocted to justify his war. Things like the false idea that the U.S. instigated the war, or that Putin, while killing Ukrainian civilians, is somehow protecting Russians, the list goes on. And it's all to paint the picture that Russia is not at fault here, which is obviously crazy. But every now and then, an article or statement comes to the surface that shows sympathy for the Ukrainians who are under fire, or the idea that China can be some sort of mediator in this conflict. Bottom line is that the narrative is dynamic and it's hard to pin down. And I think that that really indicates that Beijing wants to hedge the outcome of this war and squeeze all of the benefit that it can out of the situation. So let's not forget that early on, China and Russia inked a new oil and gas deal valued at $117.5 billion. And they also removed the restrictions on Russian wheat imports. These deals really helped China achieve some of their strategic goals of energy and food security. So it looks like Beijing is getting what they want, economic and strategic gains, while making sure that they have some way out if, say, Putin does not achieve his objectives in Ukraine.
So even on social media, we're seeing this proliferation and really not just more than just tacit support, because they're not just tolerating what's going on. They're echoing what's happening, you know, what's happening in the information sphere in Russia. So we're seeing that support of Russia through China. At the same time, China's exploiting this opportunity to better themselves and better their oil and their food security, and really at the expense of Russia.
So, Dan, does what's happening in Ukraine have any effect on how we think about Taiwan?
I think the big takeaway here is that China is watching what is happening in Ukraine in terms of the Allied response, and they're finding out what the limits are in what we will do and what we won't do to stop Putin's aggression. So trying to predict what China will do would be purely speculation, so I'm not going to go there. But we can be sure that they are watching and learning lessons that they will apply in their calculus over a Taiwan scenario. In terms of how we think about Taiwan, the main thing is really that we need to be focused on strengthening our allies and partners in the Indo-Pacific and really focusing on these partnerships. What we have learned from Ukraine is that the responses from our allies and partners have been overwhelming in terms of adding pressure through sanctions or supplying military equipment to Ukraine. And sometimes these responses have been very surprising. So I'm thinking specifically of Germany's response. So maintaining a strong set of allies and partners in the Indo-Pacific and actively deepening these relationships really adds another level of strategic surprise in terms of what our possible responses could be in the event of a Taiwan contingency.
Lucas, what are your thoughts about how space plays into this? Are we seeing Russia threaten assets in orbit?
Yeah, thanks, Slick. And I think, I mean, the short answer is just absolutely. Russia has an extensive arsenal of counter-space capabilities it can draw from, ranging from temporary reversible effects all the way up to physical destruction of space assets, both on the ground and on orbit. And really, they're meant to deny the Ukrainians use of certain space-based capabilities, particularly space-based information. And to just cite a couple reported examples of what they've been doing, so Hawkeye 360, which is a geospatial analytics company, released a press release last week where they flagged that there's a lot of GPS interference near Ukraine, both in the lead up to the invasion, and that continues to this day. And it attributed those to various Russian electronic warfare capabilities, which Russia has a wide array of options to use. And it's not just for position, navigation, and timing data, but also satellite communications and other forms of space-based capabilities. Another one is cyber attacks, which is another potent counter-space weapon in Russia's arsenal. So coincidentally, at the same time that Russia was launching its invasion of Ukraine, there were tens of thousands of SATCOM terminals that were providing broadband internet that suddenly stopped working. And that was both in Ukraine, but also in other European countries as well. And so Viasat, which owns and operates those satellite terminals that were experienced that outage, said that it was investigating the outage, but it believed it was caused by a cyber attack. And not exactly sure what the sort of the exploit that was used was or what things it tried to knock out, but the ultimate result was the loss of the use of these terminals. And I think that's actually a really interesting question for moving forward, right, is this question of do cyber attacks constitute an act of war? And so since that did target or ultimately end up damaging satellite capabilities in other European countries as well, NATO countries, you know, what does that mean for the alliance moving forward? And then lastly, there are a lot more destructive options in Russia's arsenal as well. So as an example, when Russia tested its kinetic ASAT missile in last November, a representative went on state television and warned that if NATO crossed certain red lines, they actually risked losing its entire constellation of 32 GPS satellites all at once. Right? And so that means that Russia has a significant number of ASAT missiles that at the very least can reach targets in MEO. And while these threats so far have just been sort of posturing, I think it's going to be something interesting to watch moving forward, particularly if the situation continues to deteriorate from the Russian perspective.
Hey, Lucas, I just want to jump on some things you said there, and those are really good comments. First off, recently we had a senior official over here for an event, and somebody asked about, hey, when would we ever actually get into a shooting war to defend our space assets? And the official said, well, you know, satellites don't have mothers, so we might not. In my opinion, especially in these circumstances, that is the exact wrong response, because at that point, we have surrendered any deterrent basis to really dissuade an adversary from going after our stuff. And the escalatory nature of that could be far more dangerous than nipping it in the bud right away. So I think we've got to get real on that with offensive and defensive capabilities in space.
Doug, I mean, what you mentioned about satellites don't have mothers, yes, but actual soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, they have mothers, and they depend on those space satellites.
Yep.
So there's a cascading effect when adversaries attack our constellations, how that then impacts our warfighters. When we lose space, that really endangers the lives of our service members.
Yeah, and just to add on to that, I mean, it's not just that you're attacking that space capability, it's the implications of it. And it's not just the military elements. I mean, so much of your civil society depends on space-based capabilities as well. And if those are the things that are getting shot down or disabled, you know, that has a lot of detrimental impacts to your society.
The other question that we've been hearing a lot, too, are from the commercial providers. And obviously, and you referenced it, there are a lot of commercial systems used to support military operations. And the question right now that we're hearing asked a lot of the administration and defense officials by commercial industry is, at what point do you defend our assets? Because it has huge, huge implications for how they manage that, assess risk, and where they choose to play. And again, it's another area where I think we have to be incredibly clear and decisive, because if we don't, we are really not going to like what's going to happen, and it's going to escalate to a place that is going to be very dangerous.
Exactly right, Doug. You know, to use the schoolyard bully analogy, we're basically letting them take our lunch, and we're not doing anything about it.
All right, Gonzo, this is a big one. Why did Putin put his nuclear forces on high alert?
Now, Slick, that wasn't a surprise. It's entirely consistent with Russia's warfighting doctrine, which includes a limited use of nuclear weapons as a means to counter conventional attacks. And that's commonly called escalate to de-escalate, which really means that limited nuclear strikes are a way to compel an adversary to de-escalate. Now, I don't believe that Putin's actually going to use a nuclear weapon on Ukraine, even in a demonstration. He's got the conventional mass needed to eventually prevail. Instead, that higher alert posture was a signal to NATO to stay out of the fight and stop providing Ukraine with lethal arms and other assistance. One last point. We talked about lessons learned a little earlier, and I think there's one to learn from this. Putin's action is a blow against the global nuclear zero arms control fanatics that believe we should greatly reduce or even eliminate our nuclear triad. Now, clearly Russia and others believe nuclear weapons have valid uses, even in conventional, or better said, hybrid conflicts. So we should not gut our triad as we have so many of our other forces.
Now, Gonzo, you're so right. It is so dangerous to view the world as we want it to be versus viewing it as it is, and for us to overlay our values and assume our enemies hold the same. That is a very slippery slope.
Yeah, Gonzo, to your point, I thought that was really interesting from Admiral Richards' testimony, because I think, you know, the ICBM leg is one that people typically go after, and so it was interesting to hear him say that, you know, given the events in Ukraine, saying, you know, thank God for our ICBMs, and he kind of just left it at that, but kind of put a point on it.
And I believe Putin would not hesitate to use a smaller yield nuclear weapon, whether or not in a test or actually on the battle space, if he actually thought that NATO was getting ready to escalate or frustrate his ambitions within Ukraine. I don't put it past him, because it seems to me like that is completely within historic Soviet and current Russian doctrine, and I think it's completely within his own psyche. So as Doug said, we need to be very cautious about about mirroring. If Putin can achieve his objectives completely conventionally because we all stay out, then I agree. I don't think he'll do any kind of test demonstration or actual employment of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, but I won't argue with that at all.
I don't think he'd shy away from using it at all.
Well, and the key piece is this is about his existential survival as a leader. Mm-hmm. And so that is a tremendous motivating fact we always have to think about.
And let's talk about the nonproliferation aspect of this. What's the lesson that other nations are taking about nuclear weapons? You know, for example, where are Ukraine's nuclear weapons? Oh, that's right. They gave them up because we promised their security. We said, Ukraine, you don't need nuclear weapons because we will be your security umbrella. And how has that worked out? Same thing with Libya. Libya gave up their nuclear weapons. And what happened to their security? So I think one of the lessons that we need to be aware of is thinking how other nations are now viewing the necessity of having nuclear weapons as a means to ensure their state's survival. Take a look at North Korea. They pursued nuclear weapons, and right now no one is talking about, there's no concern for their state survival because they have them.
Well, Doug, we're hearing a lot of folks talk about Putin's munition stockpiles, especially questions regarding precision weaponry. Why do you think we haven't seen him use them more?
It's hard to say, but I would just point out that it is important for us to understand, while we value the notion of precision and limiting collateral damage and view it as a fundamental advantage to be very selective what we strike and when, the Russians don't necessarily subscribe to that. They certainly probably drained their stocks a little low in Syria, and maybe they have not replenished it. I would say the real lesson is for us that our way of war fundamentally depends on these. Our stocks have been very low, largely driven by budget and use. It's time to get real about rebuilding them.
And I think we also can't assume that those stocks are totally gone. I mean, Putin could be holding those in reserve in case NATO becomes involved, and he's required to be much more precise about what he targets.
All right, let me aim this one at both Gonzo and Heather. What are the lessons learned regarding U.S. arms sales? Are there certain types of technologies we should be looking to export to allies? And are our processes agile enough to make this happen?
Yeah, I'll kick it off. Thanks, Slick. I'll pull on my experience as a DASD working on OSD policy. What I've heard from our allies, fifth-gen fighters, without question. Many of our allies and friends know that fifth-gen is a foundation for a modern Air Force. Fourth-gen is now second tier. Advanced air-to-air and air-to-service missiles are also needed so Russian forces don't outstick us. And that includes PGMs like JASMs and LRASMs and large quantities of anti-armor weapons that can be air and ground delivered, anti-ship weapons that can be launched from shore, comm systems that are suitable for operations in areas where jamming and other EW threats are going to be the norm, higher capacity air and missile defenses as well. Patriot missiles are great, but they require a great deal of logistics support to move and resupply, and they're also kind of expensive, which means our allies simply can't buy them in the numbers needed. Our allies are very interested in non-kinetic defenses such as lasers and high-power microwave systems that we're now beginning to feel. So a combination of kinetic and non-kinetic systems can really provide the higher capacity air missile defenses that NATO needs. Kinetic alone can't do the job.
You know, and the other thing that's really important is I think we really need to shift the way we've looked at arms sales. I mean, for a long time, we've tried to prevent the proliferation of weapon sales because we're concerned about regional arms races. So as you look at, for example, remotely piloted aircraft, RPAs, we have been very hesitant to sell our RPAs, even to our friends and our allies, and build up that kind of partnership capacity. Yet we're seeing here in Ukraine that drones have been absolutely essential to their ability to target the airspace. And this kind of equipment is something that we need to be able to sell well in advance so we can build up the infrastructure. We can train them how to operate them, not just in the technical side, but also in the tactics, the techniques, and procedures, and then be able to integrate with other forces. So building up this partnership capacity is utterly essential. Again, to get back to the drones, you know, Ukraine had to turn to Turkey to buy their RPAs. Yet those RPAs, as sort of successful as they have been, or at least that we've seen on the videos that have been released, don't have the capacity, so they can't carry the armament. They don't have the range. They don't have the duration that U.S. systems have. So whether it was MQ-1 or MQ-9, by denying these sales to Ukraine, we've undermined their ability to protect themselves.
All right, let's go around the table. I want to get a final observation from each of you regarding things we should be watching.
Yeah, I'll kick it off, Slick. We've heard both the White House and DoD are revisiting their the national security strategy and national defense strategy in light of Russia's unwarranted invasion of Ukraine. Now, as they do so, I hope they revisit the one war force planning construct that's now in effect. As a nation, we simply must have the capacity to defeat Chinese aggression in the Pacific and hedge against an opportunistic move by Russia and China. And I believe that aerospace forces must be a big part of that hedge because they're the only forces that can deploy and fight tonight anywhere on the face of the earth. They're the only forces that can rapidly bring the mass needed to the battle space to blunt an invasion.
Yeah, then I'd say on the space side, in addition to the potential for continued escalation of counter space operations, I think one thing to watch is the continued and likely acceleration of the decoupling of Russian space agency from its Western partners. So notably, the Russian space agency announced it would stop selling rocket engines to American companies. And OneWeb, which is partly owned by the British government, announced it had suspended all future launches that relied on Russia after the Russian Space Agency essentially held hostage a batch of 36 satellites it was supposed to launch as part of OneWeb's planned SATCOM constellation. And then also, the potential for spillover into that civil space as well. So think the International Space Station and what the future of that might be.
I think one thing we really need to be looking at is our foreign military sales. We have got to be able to build up the capacity and the capabilities of our partners and our allies. And so that's going to be crucially important, whether or not it's fifth-generation aircraft, advanced munitions, remotely piloted aircraft. We need to change our policies to enable us to support our partners and our allies through those kinds of exports. And again, specifically with remotely piloted aircraft, because this is an important way that we can build up the capacity of those partners that may not be higher on the strength of our relationship, and in terms of our alliances.
Well, Department of State has to wake up. They're the ones holding it up. DoD wants this. The Hill wants this. Administrations have wanted this. And there's some key personalities at State that are the problem.
In terms of things to watch, it seems that over the last month or so, very clear geopolitical lines are being drawn in this new tripolar system that we find ourselves in. Where we should be watching is how these lines are drawn in some of the non-traditional allies and partners and other nations in the Indo-Pacific, and more specifically, South and Southeast Asia. So I think we have a lot of work to do in terms of shoring up our relationship with these nations. And if China were to do something in the region, it will be these nations that will be part of that response.
I'd roll in with, it's all about the 23 budget that's going to come out probably next month. The word was that it was actually going to involve some very aggressive cuts. The continuing resolution has exacerbated the fiscal pressures. And so let's look at things like F-35 buy. Does the cash remain strong for GBSD, B-21? Are we investing in things like man-to-man teaming that are absolutely crucial? If the numbers go down, then we are losing and we will not have time to catch up. And we really had a wake-up call now. I mean, this is why we were so motivated on defending F-35 last year, because we knew something like this was going to happen. So we need to reset aggressively starting this year.
Yeah, we've talked about sending signals throughout this segment. I'll tell you that our budget really is an unambiguous signal, and we can't afford to send that kind of a signal.
Amen.
Well, team, we are at the end of this rendezvous, so I just want to say thank you for being here, and thanks for all of your insights.
Well, I wish it was under better conditions, but it's good to talk about it.
Yeah, till next time, Slick.
Important topic. Thanks.
Yeah, great being here, Slick. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks, Slick.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to our listeners for your continued support and for tuning in to today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hit that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment to let us know what you think about our show or areas you think we should explore further. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Stay safe and check six.